From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. This hour, we examine two recent cases where college students have gone missing, one at Iowa State University and one at the University of Iowa, and the questions these cases raise about how reports of missing students are handled. My guests will include the Dean of Students for both universities, Dion Somerville at ISU, and David Grady from the University of Iowa. Also a graduate student, Jim Malwitz, who has researched missing student cases in Iowa. That's all coming up. First, a look at this hour's news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Over a month ago now, that was on January 22nd, when Iowa State senior and graphic design major Jonathan Lacina left a party in Ames, he told his friends he was going home. That was the last time Lacina was seen. 8 days later, his father reported him missing, and the university coordinated an extensive search effort. But despite the efforts, Lacina's whereabouts are still unknown. In another missing student case, this one last September, University of Iowa business major Jacques Simelome went missing. Simelome was an immigrant from Haiti, and on October 10th, Simelome's body was found in the Cedar River. His death has been ruled a suicide. In that case, the University of Iowa did not initiate a search effort for the missing student. This hour, we want to talk about missing student cases and mental health problems among college students. How do universities and colleges react when a student goes missing? How can tragedies like Jacques Simelome's be prevented? How do the parents of college students fit into the picture? Joining me, first of all, to begin this discussion, Dion Somerville. She is ISU's Dean of Students, also leads the university's critical incident response team. She joins us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Ames. Good afternoon to you, Dean Somerville.
Good afternoon.
Also joining us, Dean David Grady, University of Iowa Associate Vice President and Dean of Students in the studios of Iowa City at Iowa Public Radio. Good afternoon to you, Dean Grady.
Good afternoon.
And Jim Malwitz. He is a University of Iowa graduate student at the School of Journalism and Mass Communication. He has researched missing student cases in Iowa, especially the Simelome case. He's written about it in his blog, especially at length, his blog, iowacitydigress.com. Jim Malwitz, thank you for joining our discussion.
It's great to be here, Ben.
Dean Somerville, let me turn to you first of all. What is the latest in the case of Jonathan Lacina?
Well, the most recent information is that the investigation and search are continuing. As you pointed out earlier, the original search did not result in finding John, and so law enforcement continues to follow up on leads very actively. They've actively engaged other law enforcement units, and we continue to try and make sure information is available so that those who may have information about John's whereabouts will come forward.
And in fact, the Lacina family has offered a $10,000 reward for anyone offering information that leads to the location of John. Also, from our report on Iowa Public Radio this morning, Iowa State University Police Chief Jerry Stewart says investigators were unable to find many leads in this disappearance. And Stewart says police are using forensic computer investigation techniques to continue looking for clues to Lacina's whereabouts. Dean Somerville, what can we say about what we think or what possibly happened after 9:30 when Jonathan left this party?
We're unable to say at this point. There are possibilities that indeed he had an accident, that it could be an intentional disappearance, or that it was foul play. And we really don't know which of the three it could be. And that's why law enforcement continues to follow up on leads, anyone that they receive, and continue to coordinate with agencies so that if there is information that would lead us in a particular direction, we can follow up on that.
Mm-hmm. 9:30 was the last time he was reported seen, but just before 11 p.m., I'm looking at the timeline here, that night, approximately 90 minutes after he left this party, Lacina's cell phone logged a two-second incomplete phone call to a friend that originated somewhere in the campus area. What does that tell us?
Not a lot. They followed up with the person who was the intended recipient of the phone call, and without the call being completed, without any additional information about any sort of conversation or subsequent information from the cell phone logs, there hasn't been anything that they've been able to discern from that incomplete call.
Mm-hmm. When was ISU officially made aware of this missing student, Jonathan Lucina?
On the morning of January 30th, the father called and reported his son to ISU police.
So this is 8 days after the incident. Do we know why it took 8 days for this report?
I think it's impossible to speculate on exactly why it took so long, but college students often lead very independent lives. And I think that when a student is missing, sometimes, you know, it depends on their class schedule. It depends on their friends and neighbors. It depends on how often they contact their family. There are a variety of variables that could result in someone being alarmed at home after one day or after several. Mm-hmm. And the same with their friends or their the people they live in and near or around. There are a variety of things that that could affect the timeline from the student actually being missing to when they are reported missing.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine your office or people connected with your office at ISU get a lot of calls from concerned parents for a lot of different reasons that turn out to be perfectly fine.
Absolutely. I mean, there are students whose parents say, you know, I haven't heard from my son, my roommate, my whomever in 5 hours. And there's some that it is significantly longer. And so my office, as well as the police, not only at Iowa State, but also in Ames, follow up on those very regularly. And we do get those calls regularly. And by and large, the vast majority, the student was, you know, it was safe and sound.
Mm-hmm. Take us back to the day when ISU did learn of this, as reported by the father of Jonathan Lucina. What did this? What happened then at ISU? How did you spring into action?
Well, instantly the search and the investigative efforts went into play. Iowa State Police contacted other law enforcement agencies to provide assistance. There were searches on the very next day when daylight was available. They searched vehicles, parking lots, creek beds. Star One, the search team, the county sheriff's office, Ames Police did an extensive ground search, used aircraft, helicopters, teams of canine teams. In addition to all of that, university staff searched mechanical rooms, elevator shafts, steam tunnels, just a variety of places. I think that as soon as we found out, we were able to respond immediately to begin looking at different places where John could be. Our critical incident response team convened to talk through what are some of the ways that law enforcement efforts could be supported, what could we do for our student community, and different things of that nature. And very honestly, how could we help engage not only the campus community, but the larger Ames Central Iowa community in helping us find John Lucina?
Dean Somerville, in just a moment, we'll hear about the Similholm case at the University of Iowa, where it was not made public, the missing student. And we'll talk about the circumstances of that case in a moment. But in your critical response team, what leads to the decision of whether to make a reported missing student public or not?
In this situation, we didn't have any reason to not go public. We felt it was very important to create awareness, and we knew that the public's help can be absolutely essential. I mean, very honestly, the fact that our television stations in the area covered it, that his picture was on the television, it was on our website, that we had flyers out very quickly, and that students were able to pick those flyers up and take them places. It's online, and they can attach mm-hmm. it to their Facebook pages. We wanted to make sure that we had exhausted every avenue that we could think of to create awareness. We understand that we are a public institution and that we want to make sure that all of our stakeholders have information, including our students, faculty, staff, and people who live in our area.
What would be some cases, even if they were hypothetical, that you haven't dealt with, in which you would, as a critical incident response team, choose not to go public with a missing student report?
At this point, we really can't think of anywhere we would not. And I think that every situation is very different, and every situation has its own set of circumstances and facts around it that really warrant individuated attention. For us, we did not have that situation occur with us with John. And so we're very thankful for the public's response. We're very thankful to the awareness that we've been able to create around the situation.
Okay. Anything at this point that we can say to help further that, since we have the ears of many thousands of people across Iowa and in the Midwest right now, to help find Jonathan Lucina?
Just if anyone has any information regarding John or his whereabouts, to please contact Iowa State University Police. There's obviously information online, and the direct number to our dispatch is 515-294-4428.
Dionne Somerville is the Iowa State University Dean of Students. She leads ISU's Critical Incident Response Team. I want to turn now to Dean David Grady, the University of Iowa Associate Vice President, Dean of Students. In listening to that case, Dean Grady, you were not, we want to turn to the case of the Similhomme case. Jacques Similhomme went missing at the University of Iowa September 28th. This is last fall. Similhomme's body was found in the Cedar River on October 10th, 2009. His death has been ruled a suicide. You were not in your position at that point. And
that's correct.
To what extent can you comment on this case?
I wasn't privy to a lot of the information surrounding that case. I do know that in situations where some family member has a concern about a student, we'll look into that, and then a determination will be made based upon the information that's available to us at the time in terms of notifying campus, notifying parents, notifying others. We'll do an extensive search in looking at, talking with roommates, talking with faculty members, see if they're attending classes, see if there's any electronic fingerprints that are out there in regard to use of ID cards or prox cards to enter buildings, see if they've checked out books in the library and those type of things.
So it's really on a case-by-case basis.
It's always on a case-by-case basis. There's always going to be some nuance with each case.
Okay, well, we're going to continue our discussion after a short break, talking with Dean David Grady of the University of Iowa, also Dean of Students at Iowa State University, Dionne Somerville. And in just a moment, we'll talk with Jim Malowitz. He is a University of Iowa graduate student at the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication. He has researched missing student cases in Iowa, especially the Jacques Similhomme case, and we'll hear what he has found out about that case when we return. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, we're talking about missing student cases in Iowa specifically, and also a little later about mental health problems among college students. How do universities react when a student goes missing? And we want to talk about, we're talking about two specific cases, the case of Jonathan Lucina and also Jacques Similhomme. Joining us now, Jim Malowitz. He is a University of Iowa graduate student at the School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Jim, you have researched this specific case extensively, the Jacques Similhomme case. Why did you decide to research this case? What prompted you to do this as a journalism graduate student?
As a journalism graduate student, I'm always looking for stories. So what first prompted me was actually a very short story in the Daily Iowan.
The student newspaper at the University of Iowa.
Yes, the student newspaper. They had reported on, I believe, October 12th, that Jacques Similhomme had been found, or a body had been found that they thought was Jacques Similhomme, later to be confirmed as Jacques. And I was curious. It was a very short article. I was curious why I hadn't known about this before, because I'm a graduate of Grinnell College. In 2006, there was a pretty big case out of Grinnell. Paul Schumann Moore went missing, and that case was very widely publicized from the start. He wasn't found for over a year, eventually. But I was curious why I was only hearing about this case, you know, after Jacques had been found. He had been missing for over 2 weeks at that point.
Mm-hmm. So walk us through in more detail the Jacques Simelhomme case. When did he go missing? What were the circumstances?
Right. Well, he was last seen September 28th, and he was reported missing, I believe, September 30th. It's hard to say. I'm still gathering information on the case. I'm researching it more. Essentially, the way it played out, very few students, if any, knew about the case because it wasn't reported in the newspaper until later. And his father had to go door to door to raise support and gather volunteers to help search for his son.
Mm-hmm. In fact, because the University of Iowa decided in this case not to go public with the missing student report here. What do we know about that? Why was that decision made in this case when we heard about another case at ISU where it was immediately made public?
Right. Well, I've spoken with Vice President of Student Services Tom Rocklin and
at the University of Iowa.
At the University of Iowa, mm-hmm. and Charles Green, the head of the Department of Public Safety at the university. And they seem to have, two concerns from the get-go. Was the first one was that they thought, you know, maybe this was a case of Jacques wanting to be absent. I've spoken with a lot of public safety officials who talk about that. You know, a person has the right to go missing if they want, if they don't want to be found. So there was that concern. Do you want to use resources to try to find someone who wants to be missing? The other concern, I believe, and they were a little bit leery about, you know, sharing this information because it is sensitive, is the possibility that Jacques had committed suicide or was suicidal when he went missing. And there's concerns with releasing that information to the public. There's always the concern with copycat suicides when there are big public debates about that, mm-hmm. As well as, you know, what do we do if a lot of people volunteer and you know, find this body, or if they find a dangerous, you know, man threatening himself. You know, they're not trained to do that. So
let me get your reaction to that, Dean Somerville in Ames. For all these reasons, apparently the University of Iowa decided not to go public with this missing student. You said just a few minutes ago you can't think of a reason not to go public with a missing student. Things wasn't ISU concerned about all the issues that Jim Malowitz just mentioned, the liability that the university might be opening itself up to, for instance, if they have a mass search, people go out to areas, fall into the river in search of a missing student.
I think that our case at Iowa State University and the case at the University of Iowa truly are two separate incidents, and I don't think that I can speculate on exactly what happened at the University of Iowa or all of the considerations that they may have had at the time. And I think that one of the things that's important to really keep in mind is that each missing student case is very individual, mm-hmm. And that law enforcement and everyone else who's involved need to use the information that they have at the time to make the decisions that they believe are appropriate for their situation as well as for their campus and community.
Mm-hmm. Dean Grady, I know the University of Iowa community people are aware of something called the Hawk Alert in this area. When is the Hawk Alert used, and could it possibly ever be used for a missing student?
It could be used for a situation like that. It's used for to send out information regarding weather and incidents on campus that the community needs to know about. Part of the issue that I think we learned early on when we first started using the Hawk Alert is that you've got to be careful about what you put out there on that information, because what you don't want to have happen is to put out so many alerts that people aren't paying attention to it. It's kind of the chicken little sky is falling type of situation. So you've got to balance that with the information that you get out there on the Hawk Alert.
Mm-hmm. So in this case, it was deemed you were not in the position at that point. It was deemed that the Hawk Alert would not be used. If you would like to join our conversation, we're going to continue this also into the next half hour. What are your thoughts about how these cases were handled? How do you think universities should handle and colleges should handle missing students? Do we do enough to protect the mental health of college students? 1-866-780-9100, our toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100, or you can email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Jim Malovitz, what for you as an up-and-coming investigative reporter, it sounds like, what are for you the biggest unanswered questions surrounding the case of Jacques Similom?
Well, right now I guess I'm pretty clear with the way the university reacted. I would maybe like to have some more information on what information they had from the start, but a lot of that is, of course, sensitive personal information that they wouldn't be comfortable releasing. But I think what's most unclear is actually, I guess, sort of straying away from the university response is the police response. And I won't speak at length about that, but I have an incoming Freedom of Information Act request coming in, so I'll have some information to sort through. But the biggest question is, why, to me, is why Desalinas Similom, Jacques' father, had to recruit volunteers to search the Cedar River once they found Jacques Similom's car a few days after he went missing.
Dean Grady, what is the policy of the University of Iowa? Are there simple questions? Do you have, similar to ISU, a critical incidents response team that you get together when a significant incident does appear? Is there such a team at University of Iowa?
Well, we've got two teams. One, we have a critical incident management team that for the flood in 2008, that team got together and met together a couple times a day to react to that crisis situation. In addition, we also have a threat assessment team, a CARE team, where if we hear reports of a faculty, staff, or student that's in crisis, that maybe suicidal or
for instance,
or
a couple years back, we had a reported shooter that was alerted via the Hawk Alert system.
Correct. And so that CARE team goes out and visits with students and situations and faculty and staff as well to help look at the crisis and determine if there's a threat. So that's a different team that we have that we respond to. Safety of our students is of utmost concern to the university, and we take any report or concern from a parent seriously. Like Dean Somerville says, we know that sometimes students are, they won't be in the residence hall room. They're going to be in class. They're going to be at the library. Their cell phone is dead. We have more than a few dead zones on campus where cell phones can't be picked up. And sometimes because of the situation, students are avoiding talking to their parents. They're withdrawn too much from the ATM or they've gotten bad grade reports.
Okay, very good. You provide a perfect segue to what we're going to talk about when we pick up after a break for a few minutes. Dean Grady, University of Iowa Associate Vice President, Dean of Students, with us this hour. Also, Dion Somerville, Dean of ISU Students, and Jim Malovitz, a University of Iowa graduate student in the School of Journalism. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. When we come back, we want to dig a little bit deeper, find out what's behind these cases, what pressures are on college students and affecting their mental health. When we come back, this is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Glad to have you with us over the noon hour. I'm Ben Kiefer. Are we doing enough for gifted students? Tomorrow on this program, we talk about academic acceleration, advancing students at a rate that matches their potential. I'll be joined by Nick Colangelo, among others. Nick Colangelo of the University of Iowa Bell and Blank Center. The center is at the forefront nationally of research to demonstrate the importance of having a national policy for academic acceleration so that gifted students are not left behind. That tomorrow here on The Exchange. Today, talking about missing students. talking in the first half hour about two cases of missing students in recent times, one at Iowa State University, the case of Jonathan Lacina. He is has been missing since January 22nd. His whereabouts are unknown. And the case of Jacques Simelholm, a immigrant from Haiti. Last September, he disappeared, and later his body was found in the Cedar River. Joining me to discuss these cases and many of the questions behind them, Dion Somerville is the Dean of Students at Iowa State University, leads also ISU's Critical Incident Response Team. Dean David Grady of the University of Iowa, Dean of Students at the University of Iowa. Jim Malowitz, he is a University of Iowa graduate student at the Journalism and Mass Communication School, has researched missing student cases, particularly, in particular, the Simelholm case and other cases here in Iowa. And we want to talk about one other case that we have not mentioned. This involves Grinnell College. In 2006, a Grinnell College student went missing, Paul Schumann Moore. And coincidentally, you, Jim Malowitz, were a student at Grinnell College when this happened. Recount that case for us, because you've been involved in researching this one as well.
Right, I have. And that's, as I said earlier, one of the reasons why I had questions about the Jacques Simelholm case when I came across it. Well, basically, Paul Schumann Moore, he went missing in September of 2006, and he vanished pretty much without a trace. He did leave behind a note, which some construed as a suicide note. Others said, you know, maybe he was just trying to take a break, you know, get away, like we spoke about earlier with some students who want to just get away from the pressures of school. And there was a huge search on campus. I mean, it was a really big story. More than 400 volunteers combed the fields around Grinnell and in that section of Iowa. And the story even went national. Within 2 weeks, I believe, it was covered on Geraldo at Large, Geraldo's cable TV show. And eventually in April, Paul Schumann Moore was found basically in Grinnell's own backyard in a community swimming pool when they uncovered it. For the start of the spring season.
So presumably he'd been in his body had been in that pool the entire winter when it was covered for the season. Joining us now, the Vice President for Student Affairs at Grinnell College, Houston Doherty, joining us by phone from Grinnell College. Good afternoon to you, Dean Doherty. Vice President Doherty, excuse me.
Hello to you as well.
You've been listening to our first half hour, also the latest case recounted here by our graduate student, the case of Paul Schumann Moore in 2006. What is your reaction when you hear about these cases?
Well, of course, listening to my colleagues at these other institutions and Jim talk about these, those of us who are in student affairs and in education always respond quite viscerally, because we've all been in situations where students have gone missing for either a short period of time or a long period of time, and there are a lot of questions that need to be answered and a lot of concerns that need to be addressed about contacting family, about alerting media, about working with law enforcement, all of the things that have been discussed in the first half hour here. And, of course, what we do within the student affairs profession is work very hard to try to provide support and services to students so that students know what who they can rely on and what services are available to them. So hopefully in cases where students are feeling distressed or feeling anxious, they can take advantage of those resources rather than resorting to suicide or to leaving a campus without reaching out for help.
I'd like to go further in depth about the support in just a moment, but I want to talk about the Paul Schumann Moore case. Were you in your position at that time in 2006?
No, I wasn't. I've just begun my third year here at Grinnell. But I know that Jim was here, and Jim and I know each other from last year being here together at Grinnell.
What is the policy currently at Grinnell College on handling reports of missing students? You heard the deans from ISU and the University of Iowa share. Give us some insights about what happens at those respective universities. How does Grinnell College handle it?
Well, very similarly, we have processes and procedures in place so that when we are notified that a student has been missing, we can immediately have staff and students looking for that person. We also have a protocol where we'll contact family if we have a feeling that that person has gone missing. Of course, we have one advantage at a place like Grinnell of being a very, very small community. There are only 1,500 students here, almost all of whom are residential. So we don't have some of the challenges that my colleagues at ISU and University of Iowa have, where you're dealing with tens of thousands of students and you're dealing with students who are living on campus and off campus and commuting and the like. So consequently, in some ways, our situation at a place like Grinnell is a little easier to address because almost everybody knows everybody else, either by sight or by name. And consequently, one can really quickly do an audit and get a sense of when someone was seen last, when someone used their meal card last, when someone used their identification card to access a building. And at a small place like this, we can very quickly, literally within minutes, try to determine if a person was in class, where they had last been seen, that sort of thing. And we work very collaboratively across our campus with campus safety, with our faculty, with our student affairs staff to be able to get that information when we need to.
What criteria do you use when you are deciding whether to go public with a report of a missing student at Grinnell College?
Right. Well, in the time that I've been here, we haven't had to do that. But I think there certainly would be I can think of a situation since I've been here where we thought about it based on the fact that a student had gone missing. And we ended up finding that the student had hopped on a bus and gone to visit a friend. And we're glad that in the end that we didn't go public and involve the media with that, but probably had another few hours passed and we had not been able to identify the student or find the student, we probably would have because he had been gone overnight. He had been expected at work and hadn't shown up. He had been expected in class and hadn't shown up. And especially in a small environment like this, if within 12 or 24 hours folks aren't showing up places that they're expected to, we are going to be looking into that.
Mm-hmm. To what extent is the student's family then involved in that decision to go public with the missing report?
Well, of course, every college has some room to interpret FERPA, the Buckley Amendment, in terms of student privacy in different ways. And we here at Grinnell have chosen to reserve the right to contact family when we feel that somebody's life is in danger. So, in fact, if we got to the point that we felt that someone was in danger or was missing and we needed that family's help, we would not hesitate to be in touch with them. But, of course, we would do all we could to reach out to that student and locate that student before we reached out to the family. But we have a policy, as do most colleges, that indicates there is a point at which we would reach out to family.
Mm-hmm. Dean Grady of the University of Iowa, where does the University of Iowa stand on that question? How, in this critical response team, do you involve the family in locating a student, in the question of when to report it or to make it public?
Well, some of it depend on the source of the information about whether someone was missing. Where'd the concern come from? It come from a parent? Did it come from a roommate or some other source? And so we would first look at that. The initial information we might get may be from the parents. But like Grinnell, we do notify parents when we feel like a student is in danger. If they're suicidal, they've had a trip to the ER because of overconsumption of alcohol, I send a letter out to students' parents informing them of this so that they're aware of the situation. We know that parental involvement in situations like this can be critical to getting the student the help that they need.
Dean Somerville in Ames, I understand. My impression is that ISU worked very closely after the reporting of the missing student Jonathan Lucina with a family.
Absolutely, we have. And, you know, like my two colleagues, we have many of the same mechanisms in place to be able to check a variety of records and things of that nature. And I think that our involvement and communication with the family was very critical. And I think that their involvement and their participation has been very helpful in creating awareness about the situation. And it's ongoing. The university speaks daily with the family, and we will continue to until we find John.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to turn, before the hour ends, to this question of supporting students before they get to the point of going missing, also suicides. The statistic that I read this morning was something like over 1,000 college students per year in this country commit suicide, an astounding figure. What makes this age and the college experience such a trying time for a person's mental health?
Well, a lot of times students come to us with learning disabilities or other conditions that may have been discovered in high school before they came on campus. But it's a time of development for those students. They're getting new independence. They're learning to live on their own. Their mom and dad's not there to wake them up every morning or to get them where they're supposed to be going. So there's a lot of pressures that come on to them as a new college student and in their development in that portion of life. So at our institution, I'm sure at Iowa State and Grinnell as well, we provide quite a bit of student support services for students, everything from our student health center that provides medical support for students and educational programs for students, but also our university counseling services. That provide individual and group counseling for students to help them deal with anxiety and stress and being separated from home.
Dean Somerville, isn't a question here really not only having the resources, but removing the taboos from going to speak to a counselor, getting people to those resources without having them worry about repercussions of the fact that they have sought out help?
Absolutely. We have the same resources available. I think that one of the things that we encourage our entire campus community to do is that if you do have a concern about someone, there are a variety of entities on campus that can reach out and to help coordinate efforts and interventions on behalf of a student. Mm-hmm. For example, if a faculty member notices some unusual concerns or strange behavior, they can contact the police, they can contact the Dean of Students office. The same if a roommate notices something, they can contact, if they're on campus student, someone in the Department of Residence or off campus, our office. And we're able to help reach out to that student in a way that we hope is non-threatening, not intimidating, and allows them an opportunity to avail themselves of the resources that may be necessary for them at the time.
If I were a student in that position, my reaction would be, I'd be wondering exactly as an adult would be, what are the repercussions in terms of also the issues of confidentiality if mm-hmm. I would go to seek out help? Could this have repercussions in my academic career later in my life? What assurances can you give there?
There are two. Vice President Doherty referenced FERPA, which is federal law that protects all student academic records. And so any interactions in the Dean of Students office are confidential under those guidelines. The other thing that's important is that our student counseling services, as well as our Thielen Student Health Center, all those records are protected under HIPAA. And so the same compliance of confidentiality that you have when you go to your family physician is what you'll have in the counseling center. And so even though a client of our counseling center may be a student, our counseling center does not have the freedom to just speak to any other agency on campus unless it truly is a situation of life and death, or very rarely that we would encounter a situation of child or elder abuse.
Mm-hmm. Vice President for Student Affairs at Grinnell College, Houston Doherty, what are the warning signs people in your area look for student? How do they make themselves apparent, students who are having mental health issues?
Well, one of the things that's, I think, important for folks to realize is that those of us who work in student affairs have been trained to identify some of these warning signs and to be attentive. One of the reasons that the three colleges that are represented in on this show have master's level live-in staff in the residence halls is to be able to identify when students are showing signs of depression.
So your RAs are trained to recognize this right on their floor?
Well, Yes, exactly. I mean, not only do we have professional live-in staff in the halls, but then that we also have students who are trained, and we bring counseling staff in to train those students so that they're looking for, you know, is someone abusing alcohol or drugs? Does it look like somebody might have an eating disorder? Now, you suggested earlier that, yes, there are, students in college who are committing suicide. There are also very reliable statistics that say that actually within this age range, students who are attending college have a lower suicide rate than students that aren't. And I think one of those is because they are engaged with adults who care about them in an environment where people are trained to look out for them.
Mm-hmm. So they have a better support structure, a better safety net than a person not attending college.
Exactly. And just as Dean Grady suggested, students are going through transition and adjustments as they come to college, probably as radically as one experiences in one's life around independence, around relationships, around moving away from family. So we find that the majority of our students who are seeking counseling and mental health support are doing it because of very normal adjustment and transition issues. That would be the great majority. But sometimes those play out in depression and anxiety, abuse of substances. And what we want to do is be alert and ready to offer assistance and support to students so that they can, in a very healthy way, address the anxiety or depression or transition they might be experiencing.
What can universities do? Let's turn to Dean Grady on this question. What can universities do to prevent emotional disorders? So we've come to the point where a student has a difficulty, seeks out counseling. How do you keep a healthy, mentally healthy student before that? A student body that is mentally healthy.
Well, I think what you do is you make sure you provide those services and like others have said, making sure that students know that those resources are available, that there's not a stigma attached to them. If they go in to the counseling center, it's not going to be on their transcript or it's not going to be broadcast across campus. I mean, Dean Somerville is right. I mean, there are some times when I can't get information from the counseling center and it's confidential. They won't tell me if a student's been over there or not. So, I think making sure that the students know that the resources are available, it's part of their tuition and fees. It's not anything extra that they've got to pay to make use of those services. And on our campus, and I'm sure on the other two campuses, we have some very talented and caring individuals that work in those departments, and they can have a very positive impact on those students.
Mm-hmm. When, Dean Grady, do our parents brought into the conversation, say, I am a student still in my 20s, and I'm going and I seek out counseling. Some students, of course, would be worried that their parents would be consulted without their consent.
And under FERPA, we wouldn't be able to communicate that with the parents.
Unless
there's a release provided by the student.
What about in the cases where you're fearing the student may be suicidal?
In cases of suicide or harm to oneself, we will write a letter to the parents and let them know about that.
Mm-hmm. And that's the one exception?
Yes.
Okay, by law. Dean Somerville, what has ISU, do you think, learned from the Jonathan Lacina case? And let's hope he's found very soon.
I think that our reflection on the John Lacina case is ongoing, and I think that we'll continue to think through and talk through as a group what we can. We always want our students to live in a safe community, and we always believe that their safety is important. I think that because it's so early in the process and that we still have not found him, we still don't know a lot about in terms of the investigation, there are not a lot of leads, things of that nature. We simply don't know why he is missing. And so in terms of us drawing conclusions and thinking through lessons learned, it's still very early for us to be able to do that effectively.
Just about a minute left. I want to go to our graduate student at the University of Iowa, Jim Malowitz. You have not only looked at these three cases, but other cases of missing students. What occurs to you? What insights do you want to leave us with? And where do you want to take your investigative reporting?
Well, I guess the biggest insight here is, I think, and all the guests have spoken to it, is the importance of spreading information. And even in these tough cases when there might be a suicide or uncertainties about why a student could have walked away, I feel like in all the research I've done that most sources say, information is good. More people should know about it, when it comes to a student's safety. And it seems like some of the more successful ends to missing student cases have been aided by that spread of information, using social networking, flyers, and so on.
Okay, very good. We'll have to end our discussion there. Our hour has finished. Thank you very much, Jim Malowitz, University of Iowa graduate student, Dean David Grady of the University of Iowa, Dean of Students, and Dean of Students Dion Somerville. Thank you for joining us as well. And also, we mustn't forget Vice President for Student Affairs at Grinnell College, Houston Doherty. Thank you as well.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Jeff Schmidt. Today, all extra production by Christoph Mai, and technical support from Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange are available at iowapublicradio.org. Once again, tomorrow at this time, we'll be looking at academic acceleration, advancing students at a rate that matches their potential. My guest tomorrow at this time, one of our guests, Nick Colangelo of the University of Iowa Bell and Blank Center. The center is at the forefront nationally of research to demonstrate the importance of having a national policy for academic acceleration so that gifted students are not left behind. We hope you'll join us then. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.